Welcome to The Security Detail, a podcast by Splunk Surge, where we examine the cyber threat landscape across different industries. I'm Audra Streetman.
And I'm Kirsty Payne. Today, we're taking a pivot and we're looking at the geopolitical landscape as it relates to cybersecurity and how it can impact various industry sectors differently.
And recently, this link between geopolitics and cybersecurity has become more pronounced with the ongoing conflict between Israel and Hamas and the war between Russia and Ukraine. And these physical attacks have sparked humanitarian crises and reshaped foreign policy. And many cybersecurity professionals have also seen a corresponding spike in attacks in their cyber domains.
But this has been bubbling for a long time, you know, with US sanctions on technology from China and discussions in the UK about the security of telco. And funnily enough, most cybersecurity qualifications don't come with a module in geopolitics, but maybe they should as we look forward and this becomes an increasingly important topic for many modern cybersecurity professionals. In this episode, we hear from Dmitry Alperovich, the co-founder and executive chairman of the think tank Silverado Policy Accelerator. Dmitry is also the co-founder and former CTO of the cybersecurity company CrowdStrike. So he's well-versed in this topic of geopolitics, also hosting the podcast called Geopolitics Decanted, and he is releasing a book about China and global competition, which we'll discuss in today's interview as well. There's a lot of ground to cover in this topic, so it's a longer interview than normal, but it's full of important context for cybersecurity professionals.
And my conversation with Dmitry covers a wide range of topics, from current strategy and possible outcomes for the war in Ukraine to the role of cyber attacks and disinformation in modern conflict. We'll also discuss Dmitry's role on the DHS Cyber Safety Review Board, which investigates significant cyber incidents to help drive security improvements.
Sounds good to me. Let's take a listen.
We're recording this interview on October 20th. It's a day after U.S. President Joe Biden addressed the nation and said that we're at a global inflection point. And he was referring to the current conflicts in the Middle East and Ukraine, calling on Congress to pass an unprecedented aid package, reportedly $100 billion for the next year. And I've seen some reports that roughly $60 billion of that would be allocated to Ukraine, which reinforces the idea that support for Ukraine is not waning despite a new conflict erupting just this month. So I'm curious what you make of that, of President Biden's speech, his appeal to Congress, and how it might be interpreted by countries like Iran, Russia, and China.
We've had this debate evolving in the country, particularly in the last couple of months, about whether and how America should continue funding Ukraine as it fights off Russian aggression. But I think people often lose sight of the fact that the majority of the U.S. Congress, both in the Senate and the House, are still overwhelmingly supportive of Ukraine and understand the stakes are involved here. Some corners of the American society, they're saying, well, we don't want to be paying for that. It's time for this war to end. That argument misses a very important point, which is that this war is not going to end until Vladimir Putin decides that it ends. This is not only about what can Ukraine take back. And I think there's a pretty good moral case and a strategic case that we should not let Vladimir Putin get away with just grabbing territory and rewriting unilaterally by force borders in Europe. But it's also very much a humanitarian case of saving civilians, preventing further destruction of their country, preventing further occupation of their country. And if that support is removed, Ukraine is going to be in a very, very tough spot. A lot more people are going to die. So the people that are saying stop funding Ukraine need to appreciate the humanitarian cost that is going to be derived from that decision.
More broadly, the question of appeasement in the short term, if the U.S. does not offer the level of assistance that President Biden is requesting, what do you think the long-term outcome of that could be with the war in Ukraine?
Well, there's absolutely a strategic case, other than a humanitarian case, that you can make here that if Ukraine falls, that will have severe implications for our strategic interests in Europe that will bring us further into the Europe security infrastructure that we've been trying to disentangle ourselves from and pivot to the Pacific, something that was first coined by President Obama over 10 years ago. But if Russia is controlling Ukraine, then Poland, the Baltic states, Slovakia, and other countries are feeling much less secure and will demand that we protect those countries with U.S. forces, with more U.S. weapons platforms. The other point that I think a lot of people are not thinking about is the overall strategy for this war. And to date, the administration's strategy has been, we'll support Ukraine as long as it takes. Well, that's not a strategy. That's a bumper sticker. That's a slogan. It is absolutely fair for critics to say, what is the strategy for Ukraine to win? And what does win actually even mean? We need to start thinking about this in the long term of the traditional conflict that Ukraine has to win by waiting out the Russians. As you raise the cost to them, you might be able to get them over time, not in the next few months, may take years, to get them to decide to pull out. Just like as America decided to pull out of Afghanistan, where we finally decided that this is not worth our blood and treasure and we're not going to accomplish anything. You got to get them to think that. And that means figuring out a way to sustain this conflict for a smaller price tag, frankly, than $60 billion that President Biden is asking for, and figuring out how to develop more asymmetric capabilities to raise the cost for Russians.
And it's great to hear your take on current strategy and the future of how the war in Ukraine could evolve, because there are a lot of questions about the timeline for this conflict and how and when it could end. And with our podcast, we focus a lot on cyber. So I'm definitely curious how you see the role of cyber evolving in these conflicts.
Yeah. So when you look at cyber's superpower from an offensive perspective, the best thing you can get from it is intelligence collection, right? Understanding what your adversary is trying to do, get their plans, capabilities, and use that to inform your own strike packages or offensive action or defensive action, whatever the case may be. And Russia has been doing quite a lot of that in Ukraine. The Ukrainian SBU, their military intelligence service, just recently published a terrific report talking about a particular attempt to infiltrate Android phones in the Ukrainian military. They're used in artillery units to correct artillery and sight targets. Cyber disruptive operations are also important, but I think they're important much more on a tactical level. I think when you think about what cyber can do, the best analogy that I can come up with for cyber is not missiles or drones or other kinetic strikes, but really EW, electronic warfare, where you can have a significant effect jamming an air defense site or radio communications or drones, for example, that are doing reconnaissance or even loitering munitions that can have kinetic effects, but they're fleeting effects. And with enough effort, the other side can always figure out a way around it. And that's actually the dynamic in cyber, that you don't have some sort of super cyber weapon that you can use for the next 10 years and no one can do anything about it. In fact, the minute you use it, you kind of may lose it if the other side figures out a defense against it. If it's a vulnerability, they can patch it. If it's an intrusion, they can kick you out. The right way to use this capability is in combination with a particular tactical objective. You're not going to just jam an air defense site with electronic warfare for the heck of it. You're going to do that when you have strike missions that are coming in that you want to have them get in safely into an area for a bombing attack or whatever you're trying to do. And then you'll turn it off. And once they've safely left that area, right? So that's how cyber has been used in other conflicts as well. And particularly here in Ukraine, probably the most strategic effects that you've seen from a cyber attack has been this attack on Viasat that was done in the first hours of the war to disable some of the communication, satellite communications that the Ukrainians were using. Again, not for the purposes of just disabling their communications, but knowing that the war is about to get launched, knowing that any sort of impact to disrupting enemy communications when you're launching an invasion is going to be highly, highly beneficial for you because it's going to delay the response. And in fact, you've seen that in the first 48 hours of the war, the Russians had achieved quite a lot. They occupied much of southern Ukraine. They were able to get to the outskirts of Kyiv. It was only after that they started to lose that territory and encounter huge problems. You've also seen in the cyber domain, after that initial success, they just went after everything, right? They've unleashed like lots of wipers and other types of malicious attacks on the Ukrainian systems. But that was more about, for the most part, throwing darts at the wall and seeing what sticks. I think they got a lot of internal pressure of, hey, here are the targets, do what you can against them. And because of that lack of integrated capability and a strategy for cyber, they really not accomplished a whole lot. And in fact, when I was in Kyiv and talked to head of cyber at the SBU, Ilya Vituk, he told me that they started shifting to targets that just had no strategic value, like toy stores. And it was clearly that they were just looking for any network in Ukraine that was going to have some sort of vulnerability and unleash their wipers against them. And that was not only not strategically effective, it was actually counterproductive because it was helping Ukrainians build up resilience. It also wasted Russian capabilities, wasted their tactics, techniques, and procedures. It wasted their time doing things that are really not important. I think that's why they eventually realized that this is not having an effect. And you've seen a shift to traditional intel collection that is going to be much more impactful to the battlefield. So going forward, it doesn't mean that you won't see more destructive attacks, but I think either they will not be extremely effective or they'll figure out a way to do them in a more coordinated fashion with actual kinetic activities, which will create problems. And by the way, that lack of coordination, I know some people have said in their threat intelligence reports that there's been all this coordination between kinetic and cyber. I actually disagree with that because what you're seeing is that you have same targets, let's say electrical substations, as one example, being targeted with cyber and kinetic within hours or even days of each other. But to me, that's actually not coordinated. It's actually the opposite of coordinated, because what's actually happening, and I've had the Ukraine intelligence folks confirm to me, is that the Russians have their priority targets. They want to turn off power, for example, in this particular town. And they're basically going to all their units, the missile programmers, the cyber folks, and saying, hey, whoever can do this, go at it. Well, that's not coordination. That's just target alignment. And in fact, could be completely counterproductive if here you are as a cyber operator and you are working really, really hard to get into a particular system that will give you access to the SCADA to turn it off. And then all of a sudden, a missile flies into that system and destroys it and all of your access is gone and you just wasted all of your time, right? That is the absolute opposite of a coordinated operation that combines cyber and kinetic effects. And that's what you're seeing.
You mentioned Ilya Vituk, the head of the cyber department for Ukraine's counterintelligence agency. Mm-hmm. And you interviewed him recently for your podcast, Geopolitics Decanted. And in that interview, he mentioned that Ukraine had been dealing with somewhere around 15 cyber attacks a day at one point. And so there are a number of attacks that were stopped and that we haven't heard about because they weren't successful. And with the Android malware targeting Ukrainian service members, I believe that was dubbed infamous Chisel. And we'll link to the Five Eyes report on that in the show notes. I also wanted to talk a bit about cybersecurity in the sense that a number of cybersecurity firms are headquartered in Tel Aviv. And I saw a report from Reuters that hundreds of Israeli tech workers have stood up a war room to analyze footage to try to locate people who are unaccounted for in that conflict. And I was curious, given your background as co-founder and former CTO of CrowdStrike, what do you make of the potential impact of these conflicts for companies that are located in the surrounding regions?
Well, there's a number of impacts. The most obvious one is, of course, that Israel has mobilized over 300,000 reservists. A number of them are members of cybersecurity companies, so they have a manpower shortage at the moment, and this could be a very prolonged conflict, unfortunately, so they may not be back at work for quite some time. This has immediate impact on Israel's ability to manage their security as well. I've been in touch with some of their officials, and they're thinking about their vulnerabilities very thoughtfully. There's a big concern about what Hamas or Hezbollah may do from a cyber perspective, not just to disrupt infrastructure, but to collect intelligence. The Israelis, and I think the whole world, has been shocked, not just by the incredible brutality, just unthinkable aggression and war crimes that have been committed by Hamas against civilians in southern Israel, but also by the level of quite exquisite intelligence that they had about the Israeli military. They knew exactly which bases to target, how to get inside those bases, the site gates that are completely unmarked. They knew which communications nodes to target, which cameras to disable from the automated systems that are at the Gaza wall. So there's a great concern about how was that intelligence collected. Some of it could have been collected in part through cyber. So there's a lot of concern about making sure that that infrastructure is protected. They're doing a lot of work in this area, and they're thinking through automation and other capabilities to make sure that they can do that while they're short on manpower. And there's a lot of help that's being offered to them as well by the U.S. and Western companies. So they're in good shape, and they have a lot of talent, and they have a good grasp on the problem, but it's certainly a concern.
Misinformation and disinformation are also rampant amid these conflicts, particularly on X, the platform formerly known as Twitter. And accounts that specialize in open source intelligence have struggled to verify information, and in some cases have promoted information that was not credible. There was also the media reporting and intelligence questions surrounding the hospital strike in Gaza. So how concerned are you about these challenges with information sharing?
It's definitely a problem, not just a problem for social networking sites, but the media organization themselves. You mentioned the hospital issue. You had lots of people, both on X as well as in the media, rush to take the statements of health ministry in Gaza that is effectively controlled by Hamas at face value, that this was an Israeli strike, that 500 plus people died. And when the videos and pictures emerged the next day, it turns out that the hospital wasn't even touched. It was a parking lot that was hit. The U.S. intelligence community estimates that the number of people dead number in the dozens, not in the hundreds, potentially. And there's good information both from open source analysis as well as from the U.S. intelligence community that this was actually a rocket that was launched by a terrorist group in Gaza itself at Israel that fell short of it. So the implications of that misinformation have been huge, because you had President Biden going to the region, obviously, this week. His plan was to visit Israel and then to fly to Jordan to meet with other Arab leaders to discuss that conflict. And because of the initial uproar about this hospital, the summit was canceled. Here you had a significant impact on a really, really important piece of international diplomacy involving U.S. president that was terminated because of misreporting both in the media as well as on social media regarding this issue. There's a rush to jump at conclusions, to see a video and immediately say that this was, an atrocity committed by Hamas or war crime committed by Israel. And no one wants to take the time to actually understand where is this coming from? What is the origin of the story? There's a lot of videos that have been circulating online that have nothing to do with this conflict, that are being presented as being a crime committed by one side or the other. We all just need to take the time to verify things before it gets presented as facts, because it can have really dire impacts on the ground.
I also want to spend some time on China, specifically a report from earlier this year from Microsoft about Volt Typhoon, a China-linked threat actor that they believe is targeting critical infrastructure systems in the U.S., specifically Guam, also potentially pre-positioning against these systems in the event of a future conflict. And so do you think that the United States is doing enough to address this threat? And how might the current conflicts impact the focus on U.S.-China relations?
So I just got back from Taiwan last week, where I spent a lot of time with our senior leadership, actually took an opportunity to drive around the island and looked at a lot of the potential invasion sites and got a pretty good appreciation for how this conflict might unfold. Hopefully it never does. Having studied this conflict, and actually I have a book that's coming out on this very issue, World on the Brink, How America Can Beat China for the Race for the 21st Century. It's available on pre-order now on Amazon. The book basically argues that, A, very clear that China has desires, President Xi has desires to incorporate Taiwan. They want to take it for a variety of reasons, historical, security related, geographical, frankly, great power, interest related, and so forth. And Xi wants to do that, I believe, and many other experts I've talked to believe, in his lifetime. And the man has just turned 70, and you'll likely have this 10-year window or so that exists between now and when he may either transfer power or pass. And that is, I think, the most dangerous window for a potential attempt to invade Taiwan. I don't think it's going to happen in the immediate future. I think we have probably at least 5 years before any such attempt is likely to be made. Nevertheless, we need to start working and preparing for it now. Secondly, it's very clear to me, especially from having gone to Taiwan, that the Taiwanese people really want nothing to do with the mainland. I just don't think that there's any chance that they'll voluntarily decide to go and unify with China, and certainly not under CCP dictatorship. And the polls bear it out. Less than 6% of the Chinese public has any interest at all in exploring that. I think China's going to look at that and say the only prospect we have to unify with Taiwan is to bring them in by force. Cyber can play a significant role in that, because if you look at the Pacific, it's a huge place. The U.S. is far away. We need significant logistics bases on Okinawa, on Guam, on the Philippines to support it. And if you can use cyber, again, in a very strategic way, in alignment with kinetic operations, you can achieve significant effects to try to impact logistics, impact power, and other critical resources in those locations that can delay the U.S. response and potentially allow the Chinese to achieve a strategic victory on Taiwan. So the things that we're seeing right now are very, very concerning, not because I think that the Chinese will pull the plug and do something destructive anytime soon, but because if you look at what happened in Russian invasion of Ukraine and that Viasat hack I mentioned earlier, you literally had, I think it was 3-hour difference between when the Russians got into Viasat till when they were able to effectuate the destruction of Viasat terminals in Ukraine. Now, I can tell you from having done cyber for several decades, being very familiar with how cyber offensive operations are being conducted, that there is zero chance that they were able to do that without having been inside the Viasat network to begin with months or years prior, figuring out how to get back in quickly, figuring out where they need to get to distribute the malicious update, figuring out what they needed to do and have to craft that malicious update so that it would execute on those devices. So all of that prep work was done well in advance just to have that capability ready to be used at the right time. So to have China infiltrate those networks today with multiple Typhoon and other operations that are being conducted and develop the capability potentially to do disruptive operations when they require them is very, very concerning.
There's also the Storm 0558 report from Microsoft about an incident in June where a China-linked threat actor was able to compromise email accounts of U.S. government officials. And I know the Department of Homeland Security's Cyber Safety Review Board plans to conduct a review of this incident. So tell us a little bit about your role on that board and where that stands currently.
Yeah, I'm actually the vice chair of the board for this review. I'm stepping in because Heather Atkins, our permanent vice chair, is recused from this review because she works for Google, obviously a Microsoft competitor. And we're looking at that particular issue related to the Microsoft Exchange exploitation, but also how it may impact broader cloud providers. So obviously Heather had to recuse herself. So I'm stepping in to vice chair that review. That review is ongoing. And that's about all I can say at the moment because of that.
I understand you can't speak too much about that, but I am curious to see what you find. The Cyber Safety Review Board has done a number of investigations with Lapsus, for instance, the hacking group that targeted a number of companies, and then also Log4j, a critical vulnerability in a very popular Apache library impacting a large swath of software. So with your experience with those investigations, do you think they've been successful? And what do you hope for the future of investigations to contribute to security, whether it's the software supply chain or cybercrime?
Yeah, so the Cyber Safety Review Board was actually created by President Biden about 5 months into his presidency through an executive order where they basically tried to model it on the National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, that does investigations into major transportation incidents, airline crashes, train derailments, and what have you, with the goal of not necessarily placing blame. Obviously, if there's negligence involved or what have you, you will have criminal investigations that have been done by law enforcement into those things. But what NTSB does is it tries to get the lessons learned from those types of catastrophic problems and distribute them widely to the air industry, aircraft industry, or to airlines or train industry, what have you, so that they can learn from that and implement those lessons learned and hopefully make the world a much better and safer place. And in fact, if you look at what they've been able to do over the many, many decades that they've been around, airline safety is the highest it's been ever, right, in the history of it, I think in large part due to the work that the NTSB has done. So the hope was that Cyber Safety Review Board, the CSRB, would do something akin to that in the cyber domain, where we would look at major incidents, obviously, unlike the NTSB, we cannot investigate every single cyber intrusion. We would need tens of thousands of people for that. But we're looking at things that are impactful to U.S. national security, which is the mandate, the legal authority that we have under the executive order. And that's why we looked at these incidents of Log4j, this vulnerability that had potential to impact numerous organizations, and the exploitation of which is still ongoing 2 years later after its first discovery. We looked at Lapsus because here you had a group of effectively mostly teenagers that were able to break into some of the most well-secured companies on the planet, some of the titans of industry with huge security budgets and really capable teams. And we wanted to look at the failures in authentication in telecommunications, because one of the things we found is that they were very, very good at SIM swapping. This third review that we're conducting now is a little different. Obviously, we're looking at a very specific incidents, but that incident had broad implications, obviously, on national security. Your listeners should know that we actually, as a board, do not pick the incidents that we work with. We get tasked by either the Homeland Security Secretary, Ali Mayorkas, or the director of CISA, Jen Easterly. But I think if you look at the cases that we've been tasked with, they make total sense and were the right cases for us to work on. We are currently, the administration, I should say, currently has a proposal in front of Congress to formalize this board, because it does exist by executive order. I think it would be good to have this structured as a permanent board with its own staff and budgets. We're based within CISA, and Jen Easterly has been very gracious in providing us with some people and some money. But it would be good to have sort of our own kind of independent budget authority, our own subpoena authority as well, which NTSB has. In the Log4j situation, if you recall, that was a vulnerability that was actually originally discovered by a Chinese company, a researcher at Alibaba. And there was a lot of concern at the time. Did the Chinese know in advance about that vulnerability? Was there any exploitation that was done? We actually looked pretty extensively into that issue, worked with the U.S. intelligence community to see what they know, talked to lots and lots of industry as well. And we were able to determine with pretty high confidence that no, in fact, there is no evidence that there was any early exploitation of that situation. But the other thing that we did is that we actually talked to the Chinese government. We actually reached out to the Chinese embassy and got a statement from them as well, which, you know, again, shows you the power of this board to get things on a voluntary basis. But there were also, unfortunately, a couple of companies that chose not to cooperate and not to provide us with any information. I don't think it impacted those reviews because we didn't need to talk to every victim. And obviously, we couldn't talk to every victim when looking at some of those broader vulnerability and threat actor investigations. But you could see how in future reviews, if we're focused on one particular incident and a critical victim or a vendor refuses to talk to us, that could be a problem in us being able to complete our mandate and complete the review. So we think that a subpoena authority that's tightly constrained would be very helpful to the board and to that review. The board is also very unique because it has both private sector and government representation. But it's important to understand that every private sector person that's on the board is not representing their private sector organization. They're actually, when they're on the board, they're special government employees. So they're effectively a federal government worker when they're working for the board. So if there are any conflicts, there are actually legal ramifications for them personally, criminal ramifications if they are not disclosing them and not recusing themselves. But for the subpoena authority in particular, I think you'll assist me get some comfort that the private sector members, even as SGs, are not involved in those decisions, that it's only up to the government employees to vote on particular subpoenas that would be issued should it be granted by Congress.
The Log4j report, going back to what you just said about that investigation, there were a lot of questions about early exploitation because it was so widely used. And Serge, my team at Splunk, was actually cited in that report from one of our early rapid responses that we initiated in the hours after that public disclosure. And we keep hearing about more critical vulnerabilities. It seems like they're becoming more prevalent just in the last summer and now into the fall. And some of the challenges with patch management and responding effectively, that's one issue that's come up with the MOVEit transfer breach that was tied to a data extortion group named Clop with a large impact, thousands of companies, millions of people impacted by data leaks. And so what do you make of the threat of ransomware and data extortion, especially these groups leveraging critical zero-day vulnerabilities to just rapidly target companies?
Well, it's a huge issue, obviously, and I think something has to be done on the ransom payment side. I'm not a fan of some of the proposals that are being push forward that we should ban ransom payments, because I do think that in certain circumstances, when, for example, life is at stake or company can be destroyed, there may be no choice but to pay ransom. But I think one thing you can do is make it a little bit more difficult to pay ransom by, for example, working with insurance vendors, making sure that they don't reimburse most ransom payments. And what we've seen is that in times when the U.S. government has actually sanctioned some of these criminal groups, particularly in Russia, and make it effectively criminal for anyone to pay a ransom to them, the ransoms have dropped dramatically, right? Because people do not want to go to jail. And there's still a process where you can ask for exceptions when the circumstances are really dire. So I do think that something needs to be done to make it more difficult for companies to pay ransoms and for insurance companies to pay for them, but we should not ban them outright.
Thank you so much. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about that I didn't ask you?
Well, the only thing I'd mention is, again, we talked about the book. Highly recommend people take a look at it. It talks about the overall threat to the United States, not just presented by China, although China, I believe, is the number one threat actor that we face today that can truly bring us to a World War III. And that would be disastrous, not just obviously in terms of lives lost and physical destruction, but in terms of the impact on our economy. And the book really focuses on solutions and recommendations for solutions, but also talks about how to deal with a broader range of threat actors as well, Russia, Iran, North Korea. Really encourage everyone to take a look and read the book and hope you like it.
Again, thank you, Dmitry, for taking the time to talk. This has been a great conversation.
Welcome to I'm the CISO and I Say So. This is a segment where we ask interview guests what they would recommend or even mandate if they were a CISO of an organization in the industry that they're speaking about. So we asked Dmitry, what would he say if he was the CISO of an organization securing critical infrastructure? And here's his answer.
So what I would do is actually not focus on particular technologies right off the bat. I've always believed that in cybersecurity, we should be much more outcomes and metrics focused. So long ago, I've advocated for this idea of a 1-10-60 rule, where you look at how fast you are, because I think cybersecurity is really all about speed. You're trying to be faster than the adversary. If you are sort of in the elite group of being able to detect an incident through mostly automated means within 1 minute, investigate it with human assistance, and now with potentially the help of AI in 10 minutes, and then take an action, remediation action within 1 hour. Taking the action is what usually is very difficult because you may have to get approvals. And in most cases, not all, but most cases, if you're that fast, the adversary will not achieve their objectives. I think it's really important for companies to go through simulations of those types of realistic intrusions, look at the failures of why did it, not look at how did someone get in, because reality is someone can get in, you know, into almost any company, whether it's through a zero day or even on a patch vulnerability or social engineering. The ways to get in are numerous. But how long did it take them to get in and then try to accomplish their objectives, right? And how long, most more importantly, did it take the defensive side to detect them and to respond to that detection? And look at ways that you can shrink that time period. If you do that on a periodic basis, you know, once a quarter, for example, you will learn each and every time what more you can do to shrink that time to detect, to investigate, to respond. And that will drive measurable outcomes in your security. And that can drive your sort of budget priorities and project priorities for the following quarters and years.
It's always fascinating to hear Dmitry's take on these issues. And he was one of the first to accurately predict Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And ever since, he's closely followed the developments of the war. And Kirsty, I'm definitely curious to hear what stood out for you from that interview.
My gosh, so much ground covered, right? I mean, I know we just had our episode with the airline industry before in this series. So it was great to hear that analogy being drawn out again, how we can learn from these kind of safety incidents and critical incidents to uplift the entire industry. And it's great to hear the DHS board doing that with cyber incidents to uplift the whole security landscape and make those recommendations. I think it's a great approach. My only worry, my only question is if they can keep up with the pace of it, right? It takes a lot of time to investigate these wide-ranging incidents. And so the impact of those recommendations needs to be equally large and worth that time and effort. What stood out for you, Audra?
Yeah, I definitely agree on those points. And I think the part of the interview that stood out the most to me was about the cat and mouse effect of cyber attacks in conflict. Once an attack is launched, the other side can investigate and shore up their defenses, whether that be a vulnerability that needs to be patched and then is less useful for the adversary to use in the future. And I think because of this, I understand Dmitry's point about Russia's cyber strategy moving more to intelligence collection to inform strategy. And I'll be interested to see if attacks with kinetic impacts, like he mentioned, become a reality with better coordination over time.
Yeah, that coordination piece really stuck out to me. And I wonder if we're going to see a sort of actor-specific approach to this as well. We already see different tactics and TTPs between actors. But what if we start seeing different strategies as well? I found Dmitry's breakdown of Russia's strategy, or rather the lack of their strategy, really insightful. You know, it shows that attackers need not just capabilities, but organization at that higher level too. And it reminds me a lot of security teams who are defending. In fact, you can have all the technology and capability you like, but you do still need a good strategy to underpin that and make sure that it's working as it should be, which links really nicely back into Dmitry's CISO say-so advice.
Yeah, and I really like that advice with the 1-10-60 rule. I think that's fantastic for incident response in any industry and really just overall resilience. And I also am really looking forward to reading Dmitry's book when it comes out in April.
Yeah, so of course, we'll link to Dmitry's book in the show notes, along with all of the reports that were discussed. You can also read more about Dmitry's interview in our ongoing blog series, which you can find at splunk.com/surge.
And that's all the time we have for this episode of The Security Detail. If you like what we're doing, please share The Security Detail with your friends. You can look for us on Podbean, Apple, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks for listening.